From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Tensions between Washington and Tehran may have eased, but some members of Congress are still worried that President Trump wants to wage war against Iran. And the House today is considering a proposal to limit his ability to do that. Speaker Nancy Pelosi scheduled the vote after the U.S. drone strike that killed Iran's top military commander last Friday. Iran retaliated with its own airstrikes that targeted bases in Iraq where American troops are stationed. And President Trump has at least for now decided not to take any further military action, but he did announce new economic sanctions against Iran. Joining us now is Jane Harman, president and CEO at the Wilson Center. She's also a former Democratic congresswoman who served as the ranking Democrat on the Intelligence Committee. Congresswoman Harman, welcome back.
Hi, Jeremy. Thank you.
Well,
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. And do you think the crisis is over and the tensions have eased with Iran?
No, and maybe. The crisis is not over. The crisis is in a pause at the moment. Both sides have de-escalated immediate military responses, but they could be ginned up quickly. And many observers in the United States think we should be prepared for cyber attacks and other asymmetric attacks on our homeland. And the sadness there is that the Homeland Security Department in this administration has basically been neutered. Almost every position is held by an acting person, including the Secretary of Homeland Security.
Mm-hmm. Some members of Congress who were in that briefing yesterday by the administration said that the administration presented no evidence that General Soleimani posed an immediate threat to the United States. Other lawmakers said the opposite. Do you think the killing of Soleimani was justified?
Well, let me start with the briefing. It is very important that Congress be briefed. There's something called the Gang of Eight. I know you know what that is,
yep.
Jeremy, but maybe some of your listeners don't. It is the senior leadership of the House and Senate, plus the leadership of the two intelligence committees. I was a member of that when I was ranking member of House Intel, and they should have been briefed before the attack happened, in full, in secret. So let's start there. I don't know what happened in the House briefing, I mean, in the Congress briefing. Both houses were present, mm-hmm. except that to get Senator Mike Lee of Utah that incensed took work. I mean, he was insulted. He said it was the worst military briefing in his 9 years in Congress. And so I'm guessing that they got lectured and told not to talk. And that's not a briefing. So that was very unfortunate. Do I know precisely what happened? No, I don't know precisely what happened. But I can't imagine that without any public, careful public presentation, that we have a very good case that an imminent attack was being planned.
And by the way, just for our listeners, Mike Lee is a Republican senator, so it was very unusual for a Republican senator to come out and criticize the administration in that way. If you were still in the House now, would you vote for this War Powers Resolution that
Absolutely.
Speaker Pelosi? Yes, you would?
I would have voted for it 15 years ago. I was in the House then. I guess I'm a dinosaur. Oh, well. But I certainly voted for the 2001 and the 2002 authorizations that are justifying all these actions. I think it's 40 military actions in 19 countries since they were passed.
Let me finally ask you, Jane Harman, about impeachment, because there's news on that front as well. Speaker Pelosi said today she's going to hold on to the articles of impeachment against President Trump until she is ready to send them to the Senate. She said that would probably be soon. Is she right to wait?
Well, I think she's handled this masterfully. This is a very serious issue. And impeachment is a political remedy. It's not a legal remedy. You have to think about it differently. But I was in the House during the Clinton impeachment, and I was a young lawyer in the Senate during the Nixon impeachment. So I really am a dinosaur. But I think what Pelosi's trying to assure is that there will be a fair hearing, a fair trial in the Senate, and she's using what leverage she has, and she's so far encountered a brick would understate it, a wall called McConnell, who is not prepared to, as he says, I think it's fiddle with her, some word like that, haggle with her. About this.
But do you think that there's an end game for her, or is she just going to end up in the same situation a few weeks later than she would have?
I think she knows what her end game is. She's very, very shrewd, and she has the respect of her caucus, and she's really earned it on the House side. And I think she's trying to figure out what next steps are. I mean, McConnell has said that he's not going to agree to call witnesses in advance, but he's also said that he is going to follow the process. I'm not defending this. I'm just stating it. Mm-hmm. That was used for the Clinton impeachment. And that did have the opportunity for witnesses or depositions of witnesses at the back end. So there may be a play here that she understands and that the rest of us are going to learn about.
That is Jane Harmon, President and CEO at the Wilson Center. Thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Now to Canada, a country in mourning following the deadly plane crash in Iran yesterday. At least 63 of the 176 people who died were Canadian. Iranian officials say that shortly after takeoff from the airport in Tehran, the Ukraine International Airlines flight bound for Ukraine's capital, Kiev, turned around before it crashed. The cause of that crash is in question. Here's Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau responding to the tragedy in a news conference yesterday.
While no words will erase your pain, I want you to know that an entire country is with you. We share your grief.
Reuters reports that nearly half of the Canadian victims were from Edmonton, Alberta, and Western Canada. That's where we find Andrea Hunkar. She's a reporter with the CBC. And Andrea, let's first start with questions about the cause of this crash. A Ukrainian official says investigators will look into the possibility that a missile shot down the plane. And today, President Trump had this to say about it.
It was flying in a pretty rough neighborhood, and somebody could have made a mistake.
Andrea, has the Canadian government had anything to say about these reports that the plane may have been shut down?
Well, this is a developing story that is very new and unfolding quickly on our end, Tanya. Not too long ago, sources confirmed to CBC that U.S. officials have shared intelligence with Canada that the Ukrainian airliner was shot down by an Iranian missile. But as I say, this is a developing story, so we will be seeking, making efforts to confirm details and get reaction on that from Canadian authorities.
Yes, understood. Canada's foreign affairs minister has asked Iran for immediate access to that crash site. Will Canada be able to participate in the crash investigation?
Yeah, that is a really, really interesting question. As you say, Foreign Affairs Minister François-Philippe Champagne is pressing for access to that site. He says that needs to happen quickly so that consular services can be provided, officials can help with the identification of the deceased, and of course, so investigators can take part in the investigation on the ground. But like you say, it's complicated. We don't have an embassy in Iran, and we don't have diplomats in Iran. Canada actually severed ties in 2012, and that was over Iran's human rights record and support of international terrorism. In fact, Italy handles consular issues in Iran for Canadians at the moment. So that said, you know, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has said that Canada has a high degree of expertise when it comes to these sorts of accidents, a lot to contribute, and mm-hmm. he is vowing to make a substantial contribution to the investigation. So we will see how that unfolds in the coming days.
Your news organization is reporting that this is the largest loss of Canadian lives in an airline disaster since 1985, when an Air India flight exploded off the coast of Ireland. I mean, this is an extraordinarily sad loss. Do you know why there were so many Canadians on that flight?
Well, Canada does have a large Iranian-Canadian population. The last census put the number at 210,000. But when we speak to community leaders, they're saying it's closer to 300,000 now. So that's a little less than 1% of the Canadian population. You also need to consider the time of year that it was and a couple of other factors. It was the end of winter break for schools, so students and academics, they would take this time to go back to Iran to see their loved ones. Many were, you know, here studying internationally, or they had immigrated. And on top of that, as we mentioned, because of the severing of diplomatic ties, there were limited travel options between Iran and Canada for Iranian Canadians. Mm-hmm. So not as many options available. And then the ones that are available are not as affordable. So when you look at that, you know, there are no direct flights, which means passengers had to use connecting flights. And that meant using European connecting flights. Another limitation, of course, is that traveling through the U.S. wasn't an option because of the ban issued by President Donald Trump shortly after he took office in 2017. So that meant using these longer but more affordable routes through countries like Kiev.
Understood. And as you said, folks will be investigating, finding out more about the victims and so much more about the case as this story unfolds. Andrea Hunkar is a reporter with the CBC. Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Planet Money is the mountaineer economist behind the carbon tax. It's the baseball player trying to get a pay raise. The prisoner building a blockchain out of cans of mackerel. Planet Money from NPR. Listen now.
And while we continue to follow developments in Iran, a proxy war is heating up inside Libya. On one side is the United Nations-blessed government in Tripoli, whose biggest backer is Turkey. On the other side are rebels led by General Khalifa Haftar, who is backed by Russia. Russian President Vladimir Putin and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan have been in Istanbul this week calling for a ceasefire. For more, let's bring in Peter Kenyon, NPR international correspondent. He is in Istanbul. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Jeremy.
So remind us what's been going on in Libya since the U.S. toppled Muammar Gaddafi back in 2011. Why does it seem that foreign powers are so interested in this country?
Well, every country has its own reasons, and it's a conflict that is resistant to efforts to stop it, certainly. It's ground to a stalemate more than once. There hasn't been much, I have to say, in the way of effective international effort to try and halt the violence and bring peace. On the contrary, most of the effort we've seen seems to have been countries choosing sides and pushing for one side to defeat the other. It will be interesting to see if this latest call for a ceasefire is any more successful than previous efforts.
Well, let's talk about Turkey, which is where you are. They're calling for the ceasefire, and they've also sent in ground troops. Why is Turkey getting so heavily involved?
Well, Turkey's decision to send troops in, which has not had a huge impact on the ground from what I can tell, does indicate on the one hand Ankara's desire to play a greater role in North Africa and Libya in particular. But beyond that, Turkey just signed an agreement with Libya's government setting out controversial new maritime boundaries in the eastern Mediterranean that would allow Turkey to drill for natural gas there. And that's really upset a bunch of other countries which are interested in drilling for the same gas.
On the other side is General Haftar, who was a general under Gaddafi, then defected to the CIA and lived in Northern Virginia for more than a decade. Now he's back. His forces have just taken the key city of Sirte in Libya. What else can you tell us about Haftar and why countries like Russia are lining up behind him?
Yeah, he has had an interesting and colorful history. You've hit just a couple of the highlights. And he has drawn support from a wide range of countries, Russia, France, but also Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and the UAE. In France's case, I've seen some reporting that suggests Paris is hopeful that Haftar can finally impose order on this country that seems, as you said at the top, to be an endless conflict. But that's put it in opposition to a bunch of other European countries who are supporting, you know, their own peace process, which really hasn't been going anywhere.
Well, we talked about Turkey sending in troops. In the case of Russia, they've been sending in hundreds of snipers from a Russian mercenary squad called the Wagner Group. They've also apparently been printing millions of dollars worth of Libyan banknotes for General Haftar. What's Russia's interest and endgame in Libya?
Yeah, that was interesting, seeing all those banknotes being printed up, a new kind of foreign policy.
Yeah.
Well, there's a school of thought about Russia that says it has long wanted a foothold in the southern Mediterranean, that this is about expansion of influence. That would certainly fit with the more general theory that Moscow has always wanted to reassert a larger sphere of influence wherever it can. Now, having General Haftar seize power in Libya and be beholden in large part to Russia for that could be a way of enhancing Russian power in North Africa.
Now, does this set up a conflict between Russia and Turkey, kind of a proxy war? They're on opposite sides here in Libya, and we remember that they usually fought on different sides also in Syria.
Yes, there's a long history of conflict between Turkey and Russia. It happens sporadically, and usually Turkey does not come out on top. But in this case, I wouldn't think that there's a risk of any direct confrontation. There are these proxy fights going on. Unexpected things can happen in the heat of conflict, of course. But I think both Moscow and Ankara would much prefer to push their side and not get into a scrap with each other. In fact, this joint call for a ceasefire could be read as both countries seeing an opportunity to take over this peace process that critics say has been going nowhere under European auspices.
Where is the U.S. in all of this?
Well, President Trump backed General Haftar and the opposition last April, and that was just days after Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the U.S. opposed Haftar's military offensive and wanted it stopped. So basically, the Trump administration has seemed to be on multiple sides of the Libya issue, and the bottom line is, at least publicly, they're not taking a leading role in trying to resolve the conflict.
That is NPR international correspondent Peter Kenyon in Istanbul. Peter, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Well, now to Australia, where wildfires have already burned more than 15 million acres. That is nearly eight times as many acres as were burned by the terrible California fires in 2018. The Australian fires have killed an estimated 1 billion animals and dozens of people, and doctors are warning about serious impacts on public health. Joining us now is Arna Greta Hunter, a cardiologist and member of the nonprofit Doctors for the Environment. She's in Australia's capital, Canberra, which has recently been facing some of the worst air pollution in the world. Dr. Hunter, what kind of health impacts are you seeing?
So the health effects, we certainly have, I think everybody who's been in the bushfire smoke has experienced effect from the bushfire smoke. It's really common to have sore eyes and a sore throat, feel a little bit scratchy. More serious health effects from this hazardous air pollution, it most certainly has been seen in Sydney and on the south, the east coast and the south coast of Australia more generally, and here in the ACT in Canberra. We've seen an increase in irritation and exacerbations of lung disease. So people who have COPD or emphysema, smoking-related lung disease, people who have asthma, people who have underlying lung disease or underlying heart disease have been more likely to present either to their general practitioner or to the hospital. And we know from previous studies that these sorts of events in terms of air pollution are likely to be associated with an increase in mortality over the summer. We have, of course, had one of the hottest summers in Australian history. We've smashed records through December, particularly for the hottest day. We know that that will also increase mortality and increase hospitalisations, particularly for our vulnerable population of older people with both heart and lung disease.
Now, there are obviously the immediate concerns in people that you're talking about now that may be coming into the hospital or going to their doctor with problems right now. What about people who are not experiencing breathing issues right now? Are there long-term consequences of just being exposed to this that they may discover years later?
Yeah, so the majority of us are going to be fine, we think, from this period of smoke exposure. We're not sure as to whether a well person who doesn't experience hospitalisation will suffer significant long-term effects. There's perhaps some literature that suggests we may see a change in lung function in a normal population. This is going to be worthy of further investigation, and certainly there's research programs underway along those lines. One of the things that I think about a lot as a cardiologist is that these periods of both heat and air pollution have significantly disrupted our exercise routine. And, you know, doctors around the world advocate that exercise is a good way to maintain our health. I think the other thing I probably should mention is the mental health effects of this. And you will have seen photos, I suspect, of the sky and the smoke that we've experienced across eastern Australia, particularly on these very nasty fire days. I think everybody who's lived under the cloud of smoke has experienced at least some transient anxiety. So really common to be concerned for your home, for your family, for those around you. But I think for a lot of people across Australia, we're really considering the impact that climate change may have on our lives now and into the future, and that that has an unsettling effect on a psychological basis. Mm-hmm. And that's the other thing we've certainly seen in the hospital environment is an increase in presentations with mental health concerns, with anxiety, with depression, and with people really not coping with the current situation.
That you're concerned not just that your home or somebody that you love could be caught up in a fire, but also that your home of Australia in the long term may not be a safe place to live.
Yeah, look, again, you may have seen some of the reports on the devastating loss of wildlife.
Yeah.
And that's wildlife that many of us feel emotionally connected to. We regard the world around us as an important part of living in Australia. We're extraordinarily proud of our beautiful country. And we see that that has been changed through the fire. Now, historically, Australia has always had fire, and we usually recover. We usually experience some rain after a fire period, and we've really had an extraordinary absence of rain this year, which is, I think, compounding the mental health effects.
Dr. Hunter, we've been talking to a number of people about the fires in Australia, and one thing that's come up is that Australia is a major polluter. It is a country that has a huge coal industry. The coal industry there is very powerful in both of the major parties politically. Do you think that this whole terrible situation with the fires has been a turning point? Is there a sea change going on there, and people are going to really take climate change more seriously than they have?
Jeremy, we have to take climate change seriously. Australia's been described, I think, very accurately as the most climate-vulnerable developed country in the world. We now know that climate change affects human health in a way that's measurable, in a way that's understandable for almost every Australian. I think the Australian experience can be internationalised. I hope that the world is looking at the fires that we're experiencing, the magnitude of the event, and it gives pause to the carbon targets internationally. We need to rapidly decarbonise across the world in order to address dangerous global warming. And to preserving the Australian environment is a really significant motivator, I think, for all of us to act.
That is Arna Greta Hunter, who is a cardiologist and member of the nonprofit Doctors for the Environment, joining us from Canberra, Australia. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me on.
As the situation with Iran has unfolded and oil prices have risen, Tesla's stock has been popping too. It reached a milestone yesterday. The electric car maker owned by Elon Musk is now worth more than General Motors and Ford combined. The news comes after Tesla reported third quarter profits that surprised investors, but traditional car manufacturers still produce many more vehicles than Tesla does. Joining us now for more is Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Hello, Jeremy.
Well, how big a deal is it that Tesla is now worth more than the two big three automakers combined?
It is rather mind-blowing. After all, I mean, Tesla was only incorporated in 2003. This is not an early 20th century founded company. I mean, it is marinated in quarterly losses, red ink. It burns through cash just to keep everything going. But you talk to Tesla owners and shareholders, and, you know, there's considerable overlap, Jeremy, and you sense an undeniable excitement about this technological sea change that Tesla is apparently heralding.
It was less than 2 years ago, and I think we probably talked to you about it, that Elon Musk was facing a lawsuit from the SEC after he joked about taking Tesla public at $420 a share, the joke being that 420 is a marijuana term, and people thought maybe he was high when he tweeted it. But it was at $185 a share about 6 months ago. Now it's near $500 a share.
I mean, there are a lot of things going on. This is arguably the most volatile stock on the big board, on the large cap NASDAQ listed shares. The Model 3, which is Tesla's mass market sedan, that's been an undeniable success in an overall declining market for sedans. And that has everybody stoked for the Model Y crossover and various other bullish headlines. You saw the Cybertruck. You saw a couple of weeks ago, or a few days ago, Elon Musk dancing on a stage in China about its gigafactory there and its production possibilities. That's combined to hammer, and this is key, short sellers. We know those are the traders who bet that a stock is going to fall. And as this good news prevails and cascades, these short sellers are forced to scramble to buy the stock. And so it's doubled in just 3 months.
But are the investors too bullish, given, as we said, that GM and Ford make a lot more cars? I mean, the numbers are 2 million vehicles for each of those companies in the U.S. alone last year, compared to Tesla, which shipped fewer than 368,000.
Yeah, there's a bit of this that's kind of a lottery ticket on the future of automobiles writ large and the mythic Elon Musk. You break down a Tesla and you see how far ahead is it. It is technologically from, you know, its vehicle 6 years ago is so far ahead 2020 model EVs that the legacy car makers are churning out. And so you're making an outsized bet that it, not unlike the way Google's market value drank the milkshake of newspapers and ad companies, or Amazon did it to booksellers and retailers, that Tesla and Elon Musk are about to do that to all of Detroit, and then Nissan, Toyota, everybody else involved.
How are the other electric car makers doing?
There are a handful of upstarts. There's Rivian, Fisker, there's some Chinese players, but they're mostly in the theoretical right now. You need to see actual cars delivered en masse at a sustainable price point with good reviews, the buzz, the reliability. The market right now is saying that Tesla has a several-year head start on these upstarts.
And briefly, are Ford or GM reacting to the news that they're being beaten by Tesla in valuation?
They live in a different world. Wall Street's intensely interested in their margins, their labor relations, and they don't have the luxury of burning cash the way Tesla does. But I predict you're increasingly going to see Wall Street and consumers benchmark the EVs to the best that Tesla offers. And getting there is going to be brutally difficult.
Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Prince Harry and his wife Meghan stunned the royal family and the world when they announced plans to step back from their roles as senior members of the royal family and work towards being financially independent, splitting their time between the UK and North America. BBC reporter Stephen Chittenden joins us now from Sandringham House, the Queen's private home in the countryside north of London, to talk about the implications of all of this. And Stephen, we've seen lots of reaction here. What's been the reaction there?
Oh, it's been huge, and it's been quite polarizing, really. I mean, I've been speaking to people outside Sandringham who you could broadly classify as royalists. Most of these people are supportive of what Harry and Meghan have done. They've said, well, they've got a young family, they've got to choose their role in life, and we support them. If they want to do it slightly differently, good luck to them. But, and it's a big but, they said, if they want to do it, we're not paying for it. If they want to do it and be funded by the taxpayer in terms of travel, accommodation or security, it's a no-no.
And that's not clear, right, whether that would happen or not, whether they would be on the hook for paying. Although the prince is not, he's never had a formal job before, so that's at question as well, correct?
Well, he's been a soldier. He served in Afghanistan.
Yes.
But he stood down from that role to concentrate on being a full-time member of the royal family. But you're right, it's not clear. But then what is? I mean, they talk about being financially independent, but what work will that involve? Will it involve Meghan going back to being an actor? Will they continue to receive money from the sovereign grant, which comes from the taxpayer, or from the Duchy of Cornwall, which comes from Prince Harry's father? And what will their status be? Currently, they are royals. They are both their royal highnesses. If they are stepping back from being senior members of the royal family, will they still be given those titles? All these things are not remotely clear.
I want to ask you about something else, too. While folks have been supportive, they're just saying they don't want to pay for it. We've been seeing lots of think pieces, and Twitter was on fire yesterday with basically the message, how dare they, and refusing to acknowledge some of what Meghan Markle has said she has gone through in the way of racism and sexism. They're instead calling her a social climber. I mean, in light of what happened with Princess Diana and the vitriol from tabloids and the all of those things that made life really almost unbearable, what do you think is behind all of this sentiment?
I think it's no secret that the Duke and Duchess of Sussex have a very poor relationship with the tabloid newspapers. And a clear part of this move is that they want to effectively reset their relationship with the media. At the moment, all this goes through official channels on a thing called the Royal Rota, whereby certain journalists are given access to them and they submit their material for everyone else to use. And it's a very official process, and they don't, I suppose, have much control over that. And they now want to reset it, appoint their own journalists, choose how things are covered. So by telling the tabloids that we're going to do things differently, we want to run the show, that's effectively a declaration of war against them. But, you know, they've been in a low level of war anyway. There have been skirmishes. There have been lots of opinion pieces in the tabloids about Meghan complaining that she's a... Some say that she's a hypocrite, that she tells people to do one thing and does another and so on. And you know, people have called this racist. They have called it sexist. They have called it misogynist. A lot of it has been particularly nasty. And she did say in an interview with one of my colleagues last summer in Southern Africa that before she married Harry, she was warned about the British press. She didn't believe they could be so bad, but she realised that they were.
That's BBC reporter Stephen Chittenden. Stephen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, there is nothing that can warm you up on a winter's day like a bowl of chili. And lucky for me, here and now, resident chef Kathy Guntz joins me in the studio with a few of her chili creations. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Jeremy.
Okay, now I am a big fan of chili. I actually make I would call it a five-alarm turkey chili.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Occasionally, especially when it's cold. But let's start with, what is chili?
Well, in the time we have allotted, we're not going to get to an answer. There are so many definitions. Let's begin by saying that people can't even decide how to spell it.
Okay.
Is it C-H-I-L-I? Is it C-H-I-L-L-I? Now, a C-H-I-L-E is a pepper,
a
spicy pepper, and it's a country, and it's many things. And then the question becomes, is it a soup? Is it a stew? Merriam-Webster calls it, ready for this, a thick sauce of meat and chili peppers. Clearly not food writers. There's also a whole regional aspect to this. For instance, many people are familiar with chili con carne, which is like chili with meat. The distinguishing quality of that is it has no beans. Then there's Cincinnati chili, which is served on top of, drumroll,
pasta,
spaghetti, or hot dogs. It gets better. and supposedly that originated with Slavic Macedonian immigrants from Greece in the 1920s, and it uses cinnamon and chocolate and allspice. Then I know you love this, chili verde from the Southwest.
Green chilies, New Mexico green chilies.
Exactly, with the hatch chilies.
Yep.
That's the classic pepper
for
chili verde and tomatillas. Then there's a red chili from Oklahoma. Then there's vegetarian chili from the 1970s. Maybe California, maybe not.
Well, let's start there because
okay.
You've got a vegetarian chili right here in front of me.
I do indeed. And many people would say it's not chili unless it has meat. And I would take exception with it. This is a combination of great winter vegetables, butternut squash, sweet parsnips, leeks, onions, and I added chickpeas. And the seasonings have chili powder, cinnamon, ginger, cilantro, and hot pepper sauce. And you'll see on the side, there is a condiment for this. I roasted chickpeas with cumin, ginger, and cinnamon, and chili powder. And what that does is it adds a great texture to these fairly soft but delicious and colorful vegetables, and it just punches up all the flavors that are already in the chili.
You can also, of course, put your own hot sauces on top of chili. You've got one for me right here, which looks great.
That's wonderful.
Cayenne Burn Organic Fermented Hot Sauce.
And I didn't make them five alarm, even though I know your penchant
for... Well, let me just try a
little bit. Yeah, give it a punch. Because all of these chilies can be custom designed to make it mild, medium, or as you put it, five alarm.
Mm.
right?
Let's see if I'll be able to get through the rest of the segment.
Yeah, right.
It's got a little bit of an aftertaste of heat. Okay, what about this one in the middle, Kathy?
The one in the middle, I believe, is the chorizo chili. Chorizo being a Portuguese sausage that's known for its heat. And this is with salsa verde and white beans. So I sauteed onions and garlic, added the chorizo sausage out of the casing. I added a jalapeno or a green chili, cilantro, and I added bottled salsa verde that you would get at Trader Joe's or anywhere, and some chicken broth. And then again, you can add any topping you want. You'll see that I have a huge plate in front of you with everything from hot sauces to cilantro to chili peppers, sour cream, lime. I really love that.
And then you've got a beef chili here as
well. I do. I have a beef, beer, and chili, as I call it. This is super hearty. It's made with beef stewing meat and ground meat, a ton of spices, and I used a bottle of beer because the beer flavor goes really well with the beef and then some crushed tomatoes.
You just pour the beer right in.
Right in.
What kind of beer did you use?
What kind of beer did I use? It was fairly dark, as I recall. I don't
remember. Something from Maine?
No, I don't know if it was. It should have been. Local. And then with this, I love to add a little grated aged cheddar cheese, a dollop of sour cream, because these chilies tend to be very dark, so it's fun to have colorful accompaniments.
I can taste the beer. Say that sometimes when I'm making chili, I will pour in some red wine as well.
Yep, you can do that also. That's because you're a Coco Van guy.
That's right.
You can't get away from that. But the beer really marries well. And I love that there's two cuts of beef in there, that there's these chunks of beef and then the ground beef makes it super hearty for a very cold winter night.
One of the things about chili that's so great is that you can make it, have it, and then have leftovers. But maybe you get sick of it after a couple of days. Can you freeze it?
Absolutely. Dare I tell you that I made these last week and they were in my freezer and I defrosted them last night and they almost taste better to me the way that stews improve with time. They can be frozen absolutely for well over a month. I think it would be really fun during these really, you know, cold, short winter days to have a chili party and make all three of these and put out a big plate with all of these toppings and then whatever you have left over, you pop in the freezer and you'll have another meal or two.
That is Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst, and we will have all of Kathy's chili recipes, including, I would say my favorite might be the chorizo with the green chili.
I knew you were going to go that way.
It'll all be at hereandnow.org. Kathy, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Iran's ambassador to the United Nations told NPR today that his country has finished retaliating against the U.S. That is likely a bit of relief for the handful of people who have family members in prison in Iran. Many of those families have been anxiously watching the escalating crisis, including our next guest. Joanne White is the mother of Michael White, a Navy veteran from Imperial Beach, California. Michael was in Iran in July of 2018, visiting a woman he said he was in love with. He had been to Iran before, but during this visit, he was arrested and imprisoned. He was later sentenced to 10 years in prison on charges of insulting the country's leader and posting a private photo online. A lawyer for the family criticized the charges, calling them a pretext for a hostage taking. And there are questions about what happens now. Michael's mother, Joanne White, joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
I can imagine you're overcome with worry and grief. What has it been like to watch the news out of Iran in the last week?
Yeah, it's kind of nerve-wracking. I'm just hoping a war don't escalate. That wouldn't be good for the U.S. because there'd be a lot of casualties.
And I can imagine your thoughts are directly to your son and the situation there and what this might mean for your ongoing efforts to get him released.
Right now it's at a standstill, so I mean, nothing can be done right now.
Yeah.
You know, because of all the tensions between Iran and Trump.
Michael is in prison in the city of Mashhad. When was the last time you heard from him, and what does he tell you?
The last call I had was on the 30th. And it was about 2:30 in the morning. Correct. And at that point, all he told me was starving to death. You know, I questioned about money that was put on the books for him. The money was put, but he wasn't notified of it. So he had no knowledge of it. He just told me he was starving to death. And ever since then, I've been trying to get information on his well-being with no luck.
How did his voice sound?
Well, he sounded stressed.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm pretty sure if I was in that position, I would be really stressed.
Absolutely. He called you at 2:30 in the morning.
He tried calling at 10, but I was out doing dishes in the kitchen, and my phone wasn't ringing, apparently. But he did call back at 2:30. And by 7 o'clock, I was calling the State Department. I've called the State Department so many times, it's unreal, trying to get information on Mike's well-being, you know, with no luck. No one's been able to get a hold of him. The prison won't give information on him, so I don't know.
You've also been concerned about him, not only because he's been telling you that he's starving to death, but he suffers from acute asthma. And before he went to Iran, he had been through chemotherapy and radiation for a neck tumor. Had he told you anything else about his health during that phone call?
Well, not this last phone call. He just told me he was starving to death. But I know he's had melanoma taken off his back. He's had a root canal, but he said all of his teeth hurt.
And that was, you know, while he was there in
that's
prison.
Correct. That's correct. So he did get reoccurring cancer.
Iran is also known to be holding a handful of other Americans. Have you connected with any of those other families?
No.
And so you've basically been reading about their plight along with yours in the newspapers.
That's correct. And, you know, I'm more concerned about my son because of his health. You know, his health is really declining. And, you know, at this point, I just want to know he's okay.
Is Michael your only son?
No. I have Mike, Dan, Steve, and Jeremy, and then I have my daughter, Mandy.
Mike is your oldest.
Mike's his birthday's on the 24th of this month. He'll be 48.
What would you want to see from the U.S. government right now in terms of how it's handling the crisis and potential war with Iran?
Well, I don't want to see a war because that would be, you know, like Iraq, and there would be so many U.S. service members, men and women, killed, and I would never want to see that. You know, I don't think it's worth it. I think it's unnecessary. It'd be a tragedy for me. I mean, you know, I can just imagine, you know, from what I'm going through, what would other parents go through if their loved ones were killed over there?
That's Joanne White. Her son Michael is being held in a prison in Iran. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate you taking your time.
We reached out to the State Department for an update on Michael White's case. They directed us to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's interview with NBC's Meet the Press earlier this month. Secretary Pompeo said the U.S. is working diligently to get prisoners held in Iran home.
We continue to work on that process to get every American held anywhere in the world, including by the kleptocrats and theocrats in Iran, to get them to return American hostages. We will never give up on that mission.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.